Welcome. The peace revolution now continues.
Breaker, breaker, 1-9. I'm in outer space with a microphone.
Ladies and gentlemen, let's get started. Welcome this evening to the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. My name is Mark Medish. I'm a vice president for studies here. We've come together this evening to celebrate the launch of my colleague David Rothkopf's new book titled Superclass, The Global Power Elite and the World They Are Making. The book was just published by Farrar Straus. If you don't have it, please go buy it. We've made it very easy.
Thank you very much.
As many of you know, David Rothkopf is a visiting scholar here at the Carnegie Endowment. He's former Deputy Undersecretary of Commerce. He served in the Clinton administration. He was Managing Director of Kissinger and Associates. He was also the founder of the consulting firm IntelliBridge. He's the author of a number of bestsellers, including Running the World, The Inside Story of the National Security Council, and The Architects of American Power. Upon reading it, I discovered that it was actually a very serious work of political science and political sociology, raising an extremely fascinating set of questions about the shape of power, political and economic power, in the contemporary world. It also happens to be a very entertaining read, populated by members of the global superclass, the new power elite, some of whom may well be in this audience or watching on TV. We won't name names here. David might, I won't. By superclass, David means the 6,000 or so folks who wield power on behalf of the other 6 billion people on the planet. This is a stratum that David sees as more powerful than any national government. He argues that the superclass wields a particular kind of power, that is, of global agenda setting, as he calls it. The book is a combination, as I said, of political science and political sociology and the great American tradition of C. Wright Mills, who published The Power Elite in 1956. Reading David's book, I was reminded of an older line from Thomas Jefferson, who wrote, quote, "I hope we shall crush in its birth the aristocracy of our moneyed corporations, which dare already to challenge our government to a trial of strength and bid defiance to the laws of our country." As David Rothkopf reports in Superclass, contrary to Thomas Jefferson's hopes, the new aristocracy is anything but crushed. On the contrary, it has gone global, and it is more powerful than ever, for better or for worse, as David is about to explain.
They are one in a million.
I'm glad I could be of some help.
Wealthy, influential, international, and highly networked.
I like being involved in political issues.
As their actions and interactions shape globalization.
Anybody can do it, and everyone should try.
What motivates the global elites?
We wanted to do our part.
And who keeps their power in check?
This is empire.
The global economy, global security, and even global governance have increasingly been shaped by a few thousand tightly networked people who own or run energy corporations, arms and other manufacturers, multinational media conglomerates, global financial institutions, international organizations, sovereign funds, and notorious lobbies. And in their shadows, powerful criminal or violent transnational networks are also proliferating, aided by illegal trafficking and almost $1.5 trillion of money laundering. At the core of this group are 1,100 billionaires, whose wealth is equal to that of 2.5 billion people. To enlarge their wealth and project global influence, those and other multimillionaires are heavily invested in political, military, cultural, and information domains, and in the process build transnational networks with former and present political leaders and cultural icons to make up a truly global ruling class. As globalization transforms nation states into market states, government downsize, and their domestic and international commitments shrink, the global elites expand their theaters of operations and in the process shape life on planet Earth.
There is a peaceful solution called Peace Revolution. Now let's take back America. There's a war and we're in it. I know we can win it. So let's take back America. There was a dream, so believe it and get ready to receive it. Now let's take back.
Welcome to the Peace Revolution Podcast. I'm your host and navigator, Richard Grove, and this is where we step out of the confusion, fear, and anxiety of everyday life to relax into some knowledge, understanding, and wisdom. You're listening to Podomatic's number one rated podcast in higher education. Thank you for making time in your busy schedule to tune in and grow in the light direction. Peace Revolution and all the educational media we create here at TragedyandHope.com is presented as a public service without corporate sponsorship and is published commercial free and free to the public. Thanks to the generosity of the subscribers of the Tragedy and Hope online community and the hard work of the media hosts featured at TragedyandHope.com. I encourage you to check the episode notes, references, and links for this and all episodes we publish at PeaceRevolution.org. I also invite you to click the invitation link in the episode notes and participate in the Tragedy and Hope online community, wherein over 1,000 thinkers from all over the world are engaging in a fear-free zone of mutual respect, individually sharpening our intellectual self-defense skills and practicing the universal arts of liberation. In the notes for this episode, there's a donation link for the Ultimate History Lesson, a weekend with John Taylor Gatto, which is our new multi-DVD interview project currently in post-production and with over 5 hours of interview footage. This is a collection of education which is truly valuable. Those who donate $50 or more towards the completion of this project will receive the entire DVD set as our way of saying thanks. If, after listening to today's episode and clicking your way through the notes, you'd like to know more, Peace Revolution also has several partner podcasts, including Media Monarchy, Corbett Report, Gnostic Media, The School Sucks Podcast, and Remedy Radio, all of which lead by example and are likewise commercial-free and funded by those who find their media to be of value in today's world. And the topic of value in today's world is a key theme to this episode, which happened to open with a short introduction of today's main topic. Are there non-elected rulers? And if so, who are they? And how might we undertake a study to better understand their agenda? A few years back, I found one of the best and most recent treasure troves of source material, statistics, and interviews, which is in the form of David Rothkopf's 2008 book entitled Superclass, the Global Power Elite, and the World They Are Making. Without our input, I might add. From reading, it becomes apparent that the superclass of global power elite seek to undermine individuals and nations, and thereby facilitate, promote, and protect multinational corporations and their interlocking boards of directors. They do this so as to leverage the revolving doors which undermine governments, thus creating a managerial level of non-elected rulers. It's also worth noting that there are a few significant artifacts which predate Rothkopf's observations of a non-elected ruling class. Louis Lapham, also a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, created a film in 2005 entitled The American Ruling Class, which will be the subject of study in an upcoming episode of our new video series, Navigating Netflix. Prior to Lapham's shared observations in the form of The American Ruling Class, United States Senator Barry Goldwater, in his book, With No Apologies, memorializes his understanding of the elite ruling class in Chapter 33, entitled Our Non-Elected Rulers. And, of course, these fine artifacts are linked up in the notes and references for this episode at peacerevolution.org. superclass demonstrates beyond reasonable doubt that there is a small group of elite white men who, in fact, do rule the world, at least at the bottom levels of our non-elected ruling class. And I recommend, if you purchase it, to buy it used, so as not to fund those who seek to undermine and rule over us. This book, while presenting the evidence proving the existence of a literal ruling class that is international and not national in nature, also has its shortcomings. One of which is that Rothkopf expects us to believe that these are the top tier of people in the structure, when in fact, most of the so-called ruling elite he names are worker bees who act as proxies, facilitating the will of other families and organizations in the background. Speaking of backgrounds, Rothkopf has a fascinating background, and in performing my research as part of the general grammar of his situation, I found answering the question, what is the identity of David Rothkopf, to be a meaningful journey through the who's who of the very much real elite global network. Rothkopf's level of work experience as ex-managing director at Kissinger Associates puts him on par with folks like L. Paul Jerry Bremer, who, after working for Marsha McLennan and Kissinger Associates, ran Iraq during a time at which not only were there no civil liberties, but at which time hundreds of billions of dollars, taxpayer dollars, went unaccounted for. Rothkopf is also a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and is a lifetime member of the global ruling class, which Rothkopf terms as the superclass. The introduction to Rothkopf's book at the beginning of this episode was brought to us by the good people at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, which, as we learned most recently in episode 32, How College Subverts Students, Dumbing Us Down for Profit and Power, the Carnegie Endowment is in part responsible, along with the Rockefeller and Ford Foundations, for the very corruption of our public education system. The question is, who benefits from the corruption of public education? If the students, teachers, and nation do not benefit, it is then likely, if not probable or yet certain, that the global ruling class, in fact, is the beneficiary of these actions. This episode is saturated with an institutional analysis of the global ruling class, as espoused by the ruling class itself, which is why I opened the episode not with some conspiracy theory from the internet, but with the words of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, in which it is clearly stated that corporate power, not the power of individuals or nations, has been and will continue to be in control of the majority of people's lives on this planet until those individuals take the time and invest the energy to liberate themselves through self-study and practice of the active literacies. Moreover, noting that it is the gargantuan leviathans in the form of multinational corporations and their spawning of corporate foundations which creates the knowledge gap, which is the power gap, which fuels the wealth gap, leaving we the people intellectually bankrupt as the top 1% enjoy a monopoly in every form and format imaginable. Noting further that it is the corporate foundations of J.D. Rockefeller, Andrew Carnegie, and Henry Ford which are at the root of corrupting not only our public education system, but correspondingly our political system. These special interests are the holders of the most specialized forms of leverage, through which they manipulate the lives of the other 99% of us, who are likewise here occupying this spaceship Earth. If Standard Oil, United States Steel, and Ford Motor Company, as corporations, create foundations, then those foundations have a modus operandi, or method of functioning, which will seek to preserve themselves, especially at the cost of those individuals made of flesh and blood, from whom these corporate entities draw their power. Therefore, when considering the confounding juxtaposition that is international corporations and foundations on influencing our education system, one must ask the question why these powerful foundations have taken such interest to create massive leverage and how it benefits them. For instance, when the Carnegie and Rockefeller Foundations created the pension system for teachers, as well as other groups, leverage was created. And what types of manipulation are likely to be tolerated as a consequence of the lure of a retirement pension being dangled out there as if some potential reward exists for their good behavior? What influence does the term tenure have on a teacher? Is it likely, at some point, that these offerings of illusory wealth, power, and prestige were used to achieve leverage on those who are chosen to undermine our students and their parents? I'm just asking these questions as a first step to thinking about these concepts, as we certainly are not taught in public schools in our country that our country, let alone the entire world, is dominated and managed by a group of non-elected rulers. And I'm not against reality. I just think it's irresponsible for all of us to live in it and continue to rely on inaccurate maps. Maps that do not reflect the terrain, but rather are designed to lead us directly into the pitfalls which are so profitable to the ruling class. Our lives depend on the quality of information that we have access to in any given situation, and once you know that quality in this respect means that the information represents that which exists, then you have the opportunity to create your own map, which will allow you to journey safely and effectively, delivering you to satisfaction on an increasingly consistent basis. However, since we're taught in public schools that we live in a constitutional democratic republic, and the fact that this does not any longer reflect our reality, means that we must brave our way forward into the unknown, shining the light which is our curiosity, our ability to ask substantial questions and identify valid answers, thereby making it known to other individuals that there is an accurate map to be had. And the first steps in this cartography of the non-elected ruling class is gathering data, examining the primary materials which demonstrate, in the words of the rulers themselves, how they operate. I have a feeling that the founding fathers of this country were quite familiar with the history, nature, and strategies of their non-elected rulers, and the practical application of their knowledge led to their declaration of independence from not only the British Crown, but also the British East India Company. Only after studying the primary resource materials available to us can we begin to identify and understand the myriad of evidence, artifacts, and resources which are available to further illustrate reality. Today's episode features David Rothkopf's lecture to Middlebury College discussing his book, Superclass, and articulating to the students how the non-elected rulers, in fact, rule the remaining 99% of the individuals on this planet. After David's lecture, you hear a sample of an Al Jazeera episode from their series Empire, which addresses the idea of a superclass, and it also features David Rothkopf and many, many of the participants in the superclass. It's all right here in front of our noses, and all we have to do is sniff. And the stench of the aristocratic antics underpinning our entire worldview will come clearly into focus, if you'll excuse the mixed metaphor. The point is, there are and have been non-elected rulers who have been meeting in secret and planning out the details of your life, my life, everyone's lives, manipulating our options, labeling us and undermining our potential since the day we were born. And by getting to know that which exists, dismissing the arbitrary, getting to know your opponent and yourself, you can bring their hundreds of years of planning and billions of dollars invested into subverting the billions of people here on the earth, all to a very anticlimactic end. But only after you become aware, identify what exists, dismiss the arbitrary, and start asking questions and resolving valid answers. That's not only how to learn anything, but it's also the very way that you can rain on the New World Order's parade. And they are parading right now, planning us all into extinction. What's not in their plans is us changing our habits, opening our minds, and doing some much-needed homework. What's not in their plans is you liberating yourself from the habits they use to control you. And what's not in their plans is you empowered with the trivium and thus able to dispel confusion and fear. What then will they base their plans to rule the world on if not your fear and confusion? What happens when you step up and they fall down? These questions are only rhetorical until you have a map which is reflective of reality. And that starts with one small step in the light direction. This is episode 36, The Global Ruling Class. Meet the fuckers. Thank you for your support, and thank you for tuning in and not dropping out.
It's my great pleasure to introduce David Rothkopf. I've been an admirer of David's writing for quite some time, so it's a real honor to have him here to speak at the Roatan Center. His 2005 book, Running the World, The Inside Story of the National Security Council and the Architects of American Power, which is published in 2005, is a wonderful read. I would recommend it to all of you because it's distinctive, I think, for its narrative voice. He makes the history of a powerful institution come alive by allowing those who actually walk the NSC's corridors to speak for themselves. So he conducted exhaustive interviews with pretty much all the major living players in order to piece together the story. And the result is an extremely important contribution to our understanding of American foreign policy. His forthcoming book, The Superclass, promises to do the same with the phenomenon of globalization. It is scheduled to come out in multiple languages with Farrar, Straus, and Giroux sometime early next year?
March.
March 2008. David is a visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment and president and CEO of Garton Rothkopf, an international advisory firm specializing in emerging markets, investing, and risk management-related services. Previously, he was founder, chairman, and chief executive officer of IntelliBridge, a firm offering open-source intelligence and advisory services on international issues. Prior to that, he served for 2 years as managing director of Kissinger Associates. He has also served as deputy undersecretary of commerce for international trade policy in the Clinton administration. His talk today will be on his forthcoming book, The Superclass, which in my view is destined for the bestseller list, but I probably shouldn't say that because I'll jinx it. But the topic is incredibly interesting. Those of us gathered in this room, I think, are fortunate indeed to be the first, really the first to hear it central arguments. This is the first talk he's giving on the topic of the book. So without further ado, please join me in welcoming David Rothkopf to the Middle Earth.
Thanks. Thanks, Allison, to all of you. I really appreciate your hospitality. Allison is right. This is the first time that I am speaking about this new book. And so however interested you may be in how this talk turns out, I'm even more interested. It's going to be a bit of a voyage of exploration and discovery for all of us, I think. I'll talk about it for 20 or 30 minutes, maybe, and then we can talk about a broad range of issues, anything that's on your mind. I'm probably the least academically reputable discipline, which is I'm a generalist. I'm kind of interested in everything, and it makes, you know, I like to think of it as sort of enabling me to have a broad perspective. People who are specialists think of me as a dilettante. You know, I'll let you reach your own conclusions on that. When I was doing this book, Running the World, you know, a number of people would attack me for a variety of reasons. You know, when I started out, I thought, well, if I'm a centrist, everybody will like me. And let me just pass this lesson on to you. It's actually the opposite. You know, everybody dislikes you for being a centrist. And beyond the usual attacks, you know, people would pick up the book and say, oh, you were in the Clinton administration. You're a lefty nut job, which is not true. I may be a nut job, but I'm not a lefty nut job. You know, one of the other things people would get, particularly overseas, is, well, you think the NSC is running the world? And I was like, well, you know, irony, folks. There's a subtle bit of irony in here. And I didn't want to actually hold up and wave the irony sign, but, you know, it didn't come through. Anyway, so, you know, I'd get into these discussions, and I'd try to point out that some of the people within the NSC thought they were running the world, but in actuality they weren't, which led to another question, which is, well, if they're not, who is? And so that was the genesis of Superclass. And one of the books that I drew on in doing this is a book that I had to read at Columbia when I was an undergraduate because we had all of these requirements, which was a book by a guy named C. Wright Mills, who was a famous and academically respected lefty nutjob from Columbia, who wrote a book called The Power Elite. And The Power Elite, which was published 50 years ago, looked at how in the United States there were political people, business people, military people that were kind of an interlocking directorate that ran the country. And nobody had sort of looked about this in terms of the era of globalization. You know, who's, as globalization is being shaped, who's shaping it? And what are the consequences of having those people shape it? And, you know, needless to say, you know, we're in a world in which inequality is growing. We're in a world in which some people have a leg up and other people seem to be being left behind for a variety of reasons. Somebody's setting the rules. Somebody's influencing the outcomes. Who's doing it? And, of course, if you go on the Internet and type in, you know, any of the favorite sort of trigger words for conspiracy theorists, there are lots of people out there. You know, I'm a Jewish boy from New Jersey, and so, you know, I grew up with World Jewish Conspiracy. And you know, and I was like, great, where do I sign up? You know, I mean, there aren't that many Jews. I could, like, get a good job in it. Something. I knew a guy once, he used to say, you know, I'm in charge, yes, there is one, and I'm in charge of world zinc prices. And I was like, you know, good. Well, as it turns out, you know, things actually, if you study it a little bit, haven't turned out so well for the Jews over history. And you got to think that if there were a world Jewish conspiracy, they would have turned out a little bit better. So, you know, there are a whole host of theories like that about different groups that are in charge, and there have been throughout time. And so the question was, well, what's really going on? You know, do these people really, you know, are there people who really get together in a back room? How do elites interact with each other? How are they interacting with the rest of us? And what are the consequences? And so what I, you know, did first as I started to examine it was I looked at the concentration of power to see whether there was any kind of real pattern that would strike you. And strike me, it did. I mean, it's really, really striking. For example, the top 2,000 companies in the world have 70 million employees worldwide. If you add in their families, that's probably 450, 500 million people associated with those top 2,000 companies. So the CEOs of those companies are daily making decisions that impact the lives of 500 million people. But it's more than that, because there are companies that supply to those companies. There are companies that distribute for those companies. You know, there are 30,000 companies in the Procter & Gamble family of suppliers and distributors and so forth. So you look at that and you think, wow, those CEOs are making decisions that may be affecting a multiple. Well, let's just say the multiple's 2. There's 6-7 billion people on Earth, but the bottom 4 billion people on Earth, they don't have anything. I mean, literally, we're at a point where the top 1,000 people in terms of wealth on Earth and billionaires have the same wealth as the bottom 2.5 billion people. Okay? That's the world you live in, right? And so these 2,000 are impacting, of the 2 billion who actually make a living, half of them. We think, wow, that's kind of interesting, those CEOs. But surely the CEOs report to somebody. And the answer is, yes, they do. They report to the people who determine whether they get to keep in their jobs, which are shareholders. Well, how did the shareholders show whether they like the company or not? They trade stock. They sell it or they buy it. Well, 30 to 50% of all the trading that takes place in global financial markets is conducted by hedge funds, of which there are only 10,000 on Earth. But the top 300 hedge funds control something in the neighborhood of 80 or 85% of all the trading that they do, all, hold all the assets, and thus control the trading. The top 100 control 60 or 65% of the assets, and thus the trading. So now you've got a small, small group of super influential chief investment officers controlling the fate of a small, small group of CEOs who control the fate of billions of people. And if you look at it, place after place after place, there's super concentration. Of the 4,000 religions in the world, there are only 10 that have over a million adherents. There are only two, if you define them broadly, Christianity and Islam, that have a billion adherents. So very concentrated. There are only two people in the world that have the ability, I mean, there are two people in the world that have the ability to have launch authority over 90% of the world's nuclear weapons. Right? The President of the United States and the President of Russia. There's really only one army in the world that has the ability to wage a global war. There are only a handful that have anything like a modern air force or a modern navy. So, military or in religion or in politics, in business and in finance, there are very, very few people. So what I did was I said, let's define this top tier. Let's come up with a definition. The definition I came up with, and there's a lot of ways to do this, I'm doing this just to, you know, to illustrate the issue, was people who regularly made decisions that affected the lives of millions of people across borders. We'll define that group as a global superclass. How many are there? And so we started counting them up. You know, the heads of the biggest companies, the heads of the biggest financial institutions, the heads of the biggest government agencies, in governments that could do that. Most governments in the world don't actually influence millions of people across borders. Most of them are inwardly focused, and most people in them are fairly weak and can't make decisions that impact them. So we ended up with about 6,000 people. 6,000 people out of 6 billion people. So each one of those 6,000 people is one in a million. And those 6,000 people we were then able to study. And when you look at a group of people like that, you see some really stark and fascinating things, some of which might not surprise you, some of which might outrage you. 94.7% of those people are men. Okay, but just as a footnote, more than half of the people on the planet are women. The single most underrepresented group of people on the planet in the world's power elite are women. Okay? Most of them are old white guys. They're average about 60 years old. They're on one side of the Atlantic or the other. Kind of astonishingly to me, almost 30% of them went to one of just 20 colleges. This is 6,000 people from every corner of the earth. And if you pick this list of 20 colleges, almost 30% of them went to one of those 20 colleges. So it's a pretty homogeneous group. And then periodically you would find them gathered in places around the world. Davos, Switzerland, for the World Economic Forum. You got a couple of thousand of people like that. Or at Bilderberg, or at the Bohemian Grove, or at the Boao Forum in China, or at Carlos Slim Helou's fathers and sons meeting, which he has set up for the fathers and the heirs to the biggest businesses in Latin America. And, you know, in every industry, there are things like this where you get the top guys together, but they're meeting with each other. And if you look more closely at the group, you notice that this group has globalized more rapidly than any other group. Why? Well, first of all, they have the means to globalize. Now, they've got internet access and they've got phones and stuff, but a lot of them have planes. You know, a lot of them have the ability to travel easily. You know, there are 10,000 private jet aircraft in the world. And of the 10,000 private jet aircraft, maybe 1,500 of them are Gulfstream G5 aircraft. And there are a bunch of other makers of those kind of things. But there are a few thousand people, the people who run companies and governments. We're going someplace isn't about a pain in the neck. You know, they don't wait in line to go through. You know, you just call up the guy and say, you know, get the plane ready. You go down to the general aviation terminal. You get on the plane. If the weather's lousy, you tell the pilot that you want to go to Barbados. I mean, it's not quite that simple. But it's a lot easier for them to get around and to go to these forums and interact with each other. So this is the most rapidly globalizing group on the planet. They are also, however, the group that is having the greatest influence on globalization. Now, having said all of that, these guys, and they are mostly guys, these guys are not, you know, co-conspirators. Many of them are rivals. But what happens is that periodically their interests align. If you're a billionaire or you're the CEO of a company, even if it's competing companies, your interests align. You'd like less regulation. You'd like lower taxes. You'd like more freedom to move about from place to place in the world. And if you look at the history of the past 25 years of the world, a kind of a consensus has emerged. And I would say one of the greatest powers of the people of a superclass, because they're running the companies. You know, you ever go into a meeting, if you go into a room with a teacher, and the teacher says, you know, the funniest guy in the world is Dane Cook, you know, who's actually not the funniest guy in the world, and in fact, as far as I can tell, is not even a little funny. But if the teacher says the funniest guy in the world is Dane Cook, you know, you might think the next day to come in and say, well, you know, I saw Dane Cook in this dumb movie with Jessica Simpson, and boy, was he funny. Why? Because it's the teacher, and you're going to get a grade. And if your boss says, you know, X, I believe in this or I believe in that, oddly enough, you're going to start to adopt some of those views. So the greatest power of the superclass is the ability to shape conventional wisdom. And the conventional wisdom about how the world should work over the past 25 years, you could call it Reaganomics or Reagan-Thatcherism, or you could call it Volcker-Greenspanism, or you could, with deference to my friend Tom Friedman in the New York Times and the Nobel Prize winning economist, you could call it Friedman-Friedmanism. But, you know, what you end up with there is government bad, markets good, leave it to the markets, markets will take care of everything. Well, you know, how is that working for us all? Over the course of the past 25 years, inequality in the world has grown more rapidly than at almost any other time in history. It is almost as bad as it's been any time in history. It is worse in the United States in some places than anywhere else. The ratio of the richest fifth to the poorest fifth in New York used to be 8-1. It's now 80-1. The ratio of the salaries of CEOs used to be 25-1. It's now 350-1. Now, you've read about that. You've read about it in paper for years and years and years now. Oh, CEOs, they get paid a lot. Have you read about the change in CEO pay structures? No. In fact, you find that the closer you are to the middle of this circle, the more you benefit from this conventional wisdom. There are studies that show that companies that have boards that have more professional directors on them, in other words, directors who are on a number of boards, pay their CEOs more, not less, even though there is not a single study that demonstrates that a big-name CEO improves performance. Not a single one. There's no evidence to support that this is a good idea. And in fact, there's some evidence to support the idea that it's not a good idea. So inequality is growing everywhere. And, you know, all of a sudden, you know, you end up being drawn back to, I'm sure an economist, some of you have studied in the early part of this century, Vilfredo Pareto, who in looking at income distribution in Italy came up with the famous 20-80 rule, you know, which is 20% of the people have 80% of the wealth or the income. And in fact, the 20-80 rule is strange, and it's, you know, we could have a metaphysical discussion about it because it occurs everywhere. You know, if you're breeding championship rabbits, 20% of the rabbits produce 80% of the future champions. If you're picking jockeys winning races, 20% of the jockeys win 80% of the races. If you're in the record business, 20% of the records produce 80% of the profits and thus enable you to do the. I mean, it's just, now, sometimes it's 10 and 90, so, you know, don't take me too literally here, but the point is there's incredible patterns of concentration. And in fact, one of the things that I think we need to think about as we're looking at these elites, before you start getting out your pitchforks and your torches and say, let's go march on wherever these elites are and we'll get them out of office, is A, there have always been elites. B, elites emerge everywhere. You're at an elite academic institution. Okay? You fought like heck to be separated from other people and to get into a place like this. You will benefit from this system. So you're going to start rationalizing it pretty soon. You may be starting now in the middle of my talk here. The reality is that we need elites. You know, I mean, and you can't escape them. They exist in everything. You know, look at tennis. You know, there's everyday tennis players. They look like this. You know, there's sort of better tennis players who beat the everyday tennis players regularly, this small group. There's the club champion who beats that person on a fairly regular basis. You know, you might get the college level. Then you get the top pros, you know, who are the way better, you know, quantum level better. And then you get Roger Federer, right, who's like from another planet. You know, he's from the planet tennis. And he's just better than anybody else. And Tiger Woods is better than anybody else. And Michael Jordan is better than anybody else. And Steve Schwartzman, who's running the Blackstone Group, is doing it better than anybody else. Or maybe him and Henry Kravis and a couple of other people. And in industry after industry and place after place, you get elites. They're not going to go away. And in fact, they do a lot of good things. You know, Bill Gates and Warren Buffett, they give their money. People invent things that are beneficial. There's leadership. We need leaders. So you don't want to get rid of elites. They exist. But if they're perpetuating bad ideas, or if the system is being imbalanced by the preponderance of their influence, then you've got a problem. And that's really what really gets to me, because, you know, you will go in and you will take courses here in economics and stuff like that if you can't avoid it. And what will happen is that you will see that there will be a lot of studies on income inequality. But there are no studies on inequality in the distribution of power, you know. And in your studies on income inequality, you'll read about people defending this system of leaving it to the markets. And I went around, I talked to hundreds of people, and they would say, well, you know, it's much better than it used to be, because it used to be just kings had this, and now average people can have this, although the average people are now much richer and more removed from society than the kings were. And you sort of drill down, and they say, but, it, you know, what we've got is better because it's a meritocracy. Well, wait a minute. You know, first of all, is it a meritocracy? You know. Well, you've got this idea, the Horatio Alger notion, right? Which is, if you work hard, you know, and you do everything, things will turn out. You'll succeed, right? Except that's not true. All of you know it, particularly those of you who are unfortunate enough to be, you know, closer to my age. You went to college, you saw people who were less smart than you, who now have, you know, giant homes and boats and all this other stuff. What happened? You worked as hard as they did. well, you know, there are some interesting factors in here that you don't read about in your economics books. You know, economics books, they're great because they say, this will happen because the system works this way, ceteris paribus. Okay? So ceteris, some of you, there's a, you know, it means all things being equal. Guess what? They're not. You know, this system works great, all things being equal, except all things aren't equal. One of the most central absences of equality in the system is what I would call the inequitable distribution of luck. Now, you're like, oh, well, that's ridiculous. That's, you know, what are you talking about, the inequitable distribution of luck? That's silly. This is an academic institution. We shouldn't be talking about such a thing. Well, imagine for a moment somebody just like you, your DNA even, your brain, your energy, a perfect clone who works just as hard as you, except instead of being born in Scarsdale or wherever you were born, they're born in Papua New Guinea. Guess what? They are SOL as far as luck concerns, right? It doesn't matter that they have talent. It doesn't matter that they work hard, because geography is very cruel on the planet Earth. And most people are born in places where you can't succeed, where you don't get a piece of this pie. Most people are born in places where terrible things are happening. 30,000 children die every day under the age of 5 of preventable causes. Lack of water, lack of medicine, lack of food. Preventable causes. Do you know how much it would cost to fix that? For the world, roughly 2 months in Iraq. Okay, well, who's allocating the resources? 30,000 people? That's 3 World Trade Centers a day. Who's deciding that those people are less important than the 1 World Trade Center, which has cost $1 trillion and 680,000 Iraqis and 3,000 American soldiers and so forth? Who gets to make those decisions? Well, the system gets to choose. The system has a way. It has patterns. They send people to Middlebury, and then they go off, and they run big Wall Street firms, and then they get to pay for people's campaigns, and the people in those campaigns get to be president, and the people who give the money get to influence the president on the way things go. This is just the way it happens. Of course, Middlebury is an enlightened institution, so the more that happens, the better. But there are other institutions that are less enlightened, believe it or not. And so... you end up with a system that is full of flaws in that regard. I'll just talk about 2 other things because I want to make sure that we stay within time. It's a 411-page book, and I'm, you know, on page 4, so I'm going to have to speed it up. But there are some other consequences of this, kind of big-picture consequences that are worth thinking about. One of the most important of these is this. We live in a world in which there are 2 kinds of global institutions. Any of you taking course in international institutions, you may want to write this down. 1, weak. 2, dysfunctional. Those are the only 2 kinds of global institutions that we have. Okay? They, you know, if you pick your favorite one, the UN, the WHO, the WTO, the OAS is a, you know, great one. It's a great building in Washington, the OAS is in. A lot of marble. It would be excellent for, like, bar mitzvahs and weddings. But other than that, it serves no purpose. Okay? But the reality is that this institutional void, particularly when it comes to major issues of globalization, is acutely felt. Who regulates global financial markets? Who can responds to transnational threats? Well, the answer is usually either nobody or, damn it, the United States is getting involved again. You know, I mean, it's one of those 2 things. But in some of those areas, interesting things have evolved. So, for instance, if there's a global bond market crisis, like there has been recently, what happens is that the head of the Fed calls the head of 14 banks. 14. In fact, the head of Goldman Sachs refers to this as the 14 families in a not quite as funny as you would think reference to The Godfather. And the 14 families get together in a room, and they talk about how to manage the crisis. And this is the reason that you get people, perfectly well-intentioned people, people that I used to work with in the Clinton administration, other administration, who say, we don't need regulation. We'll do self-regulation. Oh, come on. Can you imagine one of those bankers getting into a self-regulating taxi cab or brushing his teeth with self-regulated toothpaste? No, why, you can't trust those toothpaste makers, but bankers you can trust. And it's in area after area after area where big people in an industry will get together, where arms makers will get together. Now, I'm not talking about weird conspiracies. They just set up laws, they set up enforcement mechanisms, they support candidates and so forth. And what happens is that a huge amount of what is happening in terms of globalization is being guided by informal clusters of people, sometimes private sector, sometimes public, sometimes NGOs, mix. A lot of cases, NGOs get involved in important influential roles in this. Well, why is that happening? Why don't we have stronger institutions? Well, the reason we don't have stronger institutions is in order to have strong international institutions, you have to cede sovereignty to that institution. Well, let me give you some career advice. If you run for political office and you suggest that we cede sovereignty to an institution that's transnational, you will be out of business. It happens all the time. It's the third rail of politics. There was a German politician who said, let's make the EU a little bit stronger in this regard. And he was like, done, literally. The words came out of his mouth, and he evaporated like a special effect in a movie. And the same thing happens in the United States. You can't, you know, so what are we doing? Well, we're making a trade, but we're not aware of the trade that we're making. Because we preserve our sovereignty, and in exchange we give up democracy. Because the people who are in these informal groups aren't chosen by anybody. They're not. Now, are they bad people? No, they're not bad people. Some of them are, not all of them are. They actually, however, have different agendas. Corporate leaders are legally obligated to think of one thing, which is shareholder return. That's why they're paid. If they don't think of shareholder return, they're breaking the law. They're undermining the fiduciary bargain that's been struck. Most of the people in these markets, most of these influential people, and money has something to do with influence, have a different agenda than the public good. And you know, the people who say, well, leave it to the market, say, well, government's lousy. Government can't do this kind of stuff. You know, look at government bungles education, government bungles health, and so on. Well, yeah, a lot of governments do. But, you know, companies screw up too, and what do? You say, fix the company. But when governments screw up, they say, let's not leave it to the government. How about fix the government? It's a cop-out to say there is no role for government, because if you're old, the market doesn't want to have anything to do with you. If you are sick, the market doesn't want to have anything to do with you. You know, and I'm a markets guy. I'm a pro-markets guy. But there are limits. We have to know what they can help advance. We have to know what they can't. They're not going to take care of the public good. As Bill Bradley said when he was running for president, and there was a debate about this particular subject, he said, the reason for creation of human societies is not the enrichment of all of the citizens. It's something else. It's a better quality of life. Fairness is an issue in how a society works. I view the sort of the world as a spectrum, in political philosophy. Those who emphasize freedom on one hand, those that emphasize justice on the other hand. And we've been sort of overly tilting in the one direction, and you need to pull it back every so often, because there are huge, unprecedented, mind-boggling injustices taking place in the world right now. And while these people don't sit in a room and vote on it and have the outcomes happen, they influence it vastly more than we do. And if, think about it. You know, you may think, well, that's, you know, crazy conspiracy talk. But, you know, who has more influence over the outcome of U.S. foreign policy, you or the CEO of Exxon? Okay? Who is going to touch more lives? You or Osama bin Laden. You know, there are people who are in positions to make a difference. You know, if the Pope says something, there are a billion people who, at some level, are being asked to listen, and many who believe that they should listen. So if they're a small group and they have more power, what do you do? Well, what happens in societies over history is we create government structures in order to regulate that balance. You know, that's what happened. The Magna Carta says, well, you're the king, but you report to some other people and so forth. But we're in the global era. This is happening outside of the realm of countries. The biggest players have sort of floated off of geographical bounds. There are 180 entities in the world that have annual sales or revenue flow in excess of $50 billion. The majority of them are companies. A minority of them are countries. Okay? Exxon is the size of Sweden. Okay? Except Sweden is organized around the idea that the government reports to the people and supports a public good. And Exxon is organized around the idea that the CEO reports to the board and the shareholders and supports the profitability of Exxon. Not an entirely bad thing, but there needs to be some kind of balance in there. And the balance is out of the system because now, you know, corporations were created in the 14th century. The first corporation was a Scandinavian mining company that mined copper. And the brilliant idea behind a corporation was that you could have an entity that would fictionally, it would have this fiction that it was like a human. It had certain rights, legal rights, that would accrue to it. So it was within the jurisdiction, the legal jurisdiction of the government. Well, now it's above the legal jurisdiction of the government. And what you've got is big companies will go and they'll say, oh, hi, you're Belgium. We'd like to be there. We'll locate some jobs there. We'll do this. But we don't want these labor regulations and we don't want these taxes. And you'll say, sorry, fella, we're going to do that. And they'll say, well, Mr. Thailand over here, he has a different idea. You want to reconsider your position? Well, who's got the power in that transaction? Who's got the power? Well, the governments have some power, but the corporations all of a sudden have a different kind of power, and the system isn't set up to deal with it. The system isn't set up to deal with huge entities, as bigger than governments, with a global agenda, with no sort of commitment or obligation to the public good, that have the same power as the lawgivers. We've come to a point, a juncture. It's like, you know, 400 years ago in the birth of the nation state. Well, though these things like nation states, they're not, you know, they don't exist throughout history. If you look at all of human history, the idea of the nation state, which you accept as commonplace, has existed for a very small period of that history. And it's got to move on to something different. If issues are transnational and proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, preservation of the environment, spread of disease, immigration, commercial regulation. Those are all transnational now. If you don't have institutions to deal with those, then they will be dealt with in an inequitable way. And inevitably, what has happened throughout history is that when inequalities take place of scale much smaller than ours, there's a backlash. And the backlash brings down the one elite and replaces it. Now, typically what happens is when that elite, whether it's in ancient Greece or in China or in the 19th century of America with the robber barons, is replaced, it's replaced by a bunch of people who stand up and say, we are going to bring down that elite because they're unfair to you, the people. And then they bring them down and they become the new elite. And the deal doesn't really improve for the people. They're just using that as a moment to switch control from one elite to another. Well, I think we're approaching a moment of inflection because the institutional structure and the legal structure of the planet Earth isn't working for the people of the planet Earth. It's creating huge disparities. It is not keeping up with the reality of what international society is like. And changes are possible. Now, you guys say, what are you talking about? Are you saying there's going to be a global revolution? I mean, the system at the core is going to change. You know, well, no, not necessarily, but yes, maybe. And we have to think this way because, you know, I'm from a generation, I was raised, you know, I was 6 years old, and somebody said, well, there's a Cuban Missile Crisis, and the Cubans, and we're going to have a nuclear war. And, you know, I lived my entire life thinking there's going to be a global thermonuclear war. And, and all of a sudden, you know, like in a couple of months, in 1999, it stopped being our concern. The Soviet Union, the most powerful dark force on the earth, disappeared. Okay? It happens all the time that the order changes. It happens frequently throughout history that order changes. And it changes when it's unsustainable. As Herb Stein, the chairman of the President's Council of Economic Advisors, once said, if something is unsustainable, that means it won't be sustained. Okay? We are now in a situation that because of the inequities, because of the obsolescence of the system, because of the concentration of the power in the hands of a few who aren't the same as everybody, tension is being built into the system. How it resolves itself will affect everybody in this room's lives. Now, one last thing, and I will wrap it up with this 60-second thing. This group of elites is changing. They are transatlantic now. In 20 years, they won't be. If you look at the 100 richest people in China, many of them now the richest people in the world, half of them are under the age of 40. They have a different view of the world. It's going to become a much more Asian group. That has implications. Now, I believe diversity, representing the world, is a good thing. But one of the Asian views, just to be a little bit controversial about this, that prevails in all the governments of the region and many of the companies is countries shouldn't meddle in other countries' affairs. Do the deal and go home and take care of your own business. China, I'd be very happy to have your oil. Sudan, you take care of your life the way you want to take care of your life. Compared to unilateralist American evangelical nuttiness, maybe that sounds like a refreshing change. But having said that, it's morally neutral. And good and evil does exist in the world. And consequently, having a system that runs towards moral neutrality, where there aren't forces out there saying this would be better and let's advance that which is better, that's not necessarily a good thing either. And if elites are the people who set conventional wisdom, then we have to ask whether all the changes affecting them are going to be positive. And as is always the case in these things, it's not clear. It's a mix. But we got to study it. And doing this book was a first step towards studying it. And now talking about it will be another step. And sooner or later, I'll figure it out a little. And then maybe we'll all figure it out a little. But anyway, I appreciate your giving me the chance to come and talk to you about it a little bit today.
A rare species has emerged on either side of the Atlantic. Instantly recognizable by their pale coloring, slow pace, and advancing age, these alpha males are kings of a new globalized, borderless world. There have always been people in positions of supreme power, kings, emperors, prophets and popes, presidents and generals, but power in the 21st century is like nothing seen before. Gone is the idea of a nation-state as the only defining unit of global governance. Gone are the visible emblems of power. Instead, technological advances, speed of travel, global markets, and transnational causes have paved the way for new masters of the universe. What makes this breed different?
Serious money.
No longer content with only one job, the new global elite have many fingers in many pies.
Terrorism. Cinema.
Africa. Greenhouse gas emissions. Environments.
Take former President Bill Clinton. Writing books, giving speeches, routinely mingling with past and present leaders, both at home and abroad.
I'll do what I can.
Brought in to save Haiti, Indonesia, and New Orleans. He's even got time to make sure he's preserved for posterity. The way to such global power is networking. Last September, the world converged on New York for the UN General Assembly. Or was it for the Global Clinton Initiative? Jet-setting around the globe, the global elite migrate from the exclusive mountain resorts of Davos or Aspen to the sun-kissed beaches of the Caribbean to the clandestine rendezvous of Bilderberg or the Trilateral Commission. Like one very exclusive country club, the elite all have huge amounts of personal wealth, went to the same schools, sit on each other's boards, help each other do deals. Those with money meet those with status or ideas without the shackles of government bureaucracy.
Anybody can do it. And everyone should try.
And they get things done. When the cause is good, this power looks like benevolent philanthropy.
Over this last decade, we've spent $4.5 billion.
$3 billion, $65
billion. But what happens when the revolving door spins in the wrong direction? Is it right that former Vice President Dick Cheney negotiated numerous military contracts in Iraq for his former company, Halliburton? Or what about the top National Security Advisor, Sandy Berger, who promoted engagement with China at the same time as his company benefited from highly lucrative contracts? The revolving door clearly isn't made of glass, which puts a big question mark on ever needed international transparency and accountability. As a new generation of aristocracy takes on the mantles of global power, the super elite are rising to new heights, bypassing governments and borders. What effect does this emerging globalized ruling class have on global governance and indeed on democracy itself?
Well, joining me to discuss the rise and influence of the global elites are David Rothkopf, Deputy Undersecretary of Commerce for International Trade Policy at the Clinton Administration, former Managing Director of Kissinger and Associates, author of numerous works, including Superclass and Running the World. Jeanine Waddell, you are a Professor of Public Policy, former International Trade Analyst at the U.S. International Trade Commission, and author of Shadow Elite and Collision and Collusion. Jeff Fo, founder and now distinguished fellow at the Economic Policy Institute, former economist for U.S. administrations in the Department of State, Labor, and Commerce, author of various works, including The Global Class War and The Party Is Not Over. And last but not least, Moises Naim, you are the editor-in-chief of Foreign Policy magazine, former executive director at the World Bank, and author of many publications, including Illicit, How Smugglers, Traffickers, and Copycats Are Hijacking the Global Economy, and co-author of Altered States, Globalization, Sovereignty, and Governance. Welcome to Empire. Let's start with the idea that all of you have worked on, which is power politics in America. Are we witnessing the Americanization of the world system? David, let's start with you.
Well, I think America has played an enormous influence in shaping the world system over the course of the past 50 years when it was the most powerful nation and the most successful model, both in terms of government and in terms of economics. But I do think we're at a bit of a turning point. While the American model has a lot of influence, and particularly the American sort of free market capitalism has shaped a lot of what the elite is today, it's by no means certain that that's going to be the dominant model over the course of the decades ahead.
Jeff? We've always had people who have operated internationally, the Catholic Church being one 2,000-year-old model. But I think that what's happened over the last 30 years is that the type of globalization has changed the relationships between elites and ordinary citizens in countries all over the world, starting with the United States. So that in the old days, it was assumed that while there were class conflict and class battles between labor and capital, that they were all contained in the same economic system and they depended upon each other. But the globalization of the market has disconnected the elites from their fellow citizens, people who have their same passports and same citizenship. And that's what makes it different.
And in so many ways, they are certainly, those corporations, far more global than governments or than parliaments, for that matter.
Well, they have more mobility, they have more flexibility, and the ability to hide things that at least most democratic governments don't. When we just had this financial crisis, the Wall Street people came into Washington, and they said, well, not only do we have these problems here in the United States, but we're connected to this global economy out there and this global financial system that you, United States government, don't understand. Well, and that put them in a very, very strong bargaining position.
They're built to be global.
Right.
They've influenced the global system and the setting of the rules to assist them in their globalization, whereas countries are a little bit like dogs that have those invisible barriers around the yard. You know, they can't get out. They're stuck within the borders of the nation state. So now that shifts the power balance. So a company can shop venues to find the tax regime that it wants. So who has the power? The person, imposing the tax, or the entity choosing among the people imposing the tax?
But the problem with that, Moses, is that international organizations, important ones like the IMF, the World Bank, and various interstate institutions, are becoming weaker than some of those huge global elites.
There's no doubt that there is a concentrated elite that calls the shot and is very influential. That has always been the case, and that is the case today. So the notion that there is a concentration of power is an old Marxist idea, that there is an elite that concentrates power, and power concentrates even more, and so on and so forth. Except that Marx was wrong, and what we now have seen is a very intense competition at the top. And the top has become very slippery. If you look at who were the 100 top corporations in the world a few years ago, they're different in part than from they are. The rate of turnover amongst top corporations is increasing. The rate of turnover of CEOs of large corporations is changing. The 1,200 billionaires in the world, that list changes.
Yeah.
And so my point is, of course there is a concentration of power, of course there is, but globalization, contrary to what has been said, globalization is creating more competition, is making being at the top more slippery, and is generating a very different kind of dynamics among the powerful than what we have seen before.
Obviously, there have always been elites. We all know that. But one of the things that we're seeing in this age that differentiates us from previous eras is that the players, that what I call shadow elite players, play many more roles that are mutually influencing. They wear multiple hats, and we don't always know what those hats are, and their titles don't convey the power and influence that they actually have. Also, they tend to break the rules both of the state, that would be the rules of accountability, the rules of government, and the rules of the corporation. Those would be the rules of competition.
But now, before, well, they could do that, and
actually,
nobody would know. Now there is hundreds of NGOs and professors like you and researchers that call them.
But that's not the global market. All markets require rules. There's no such thing as a perfectly free market. And for hundreds of years now, we've developed rules based on the nation state. With a global market, without a global government, you've got a lot more instability, you've got an absence of rules, and it's sort of a catch-22 for capitalism.
Look, here's the reality. There have always been elites. Long before Marx defined elites as a problem. Thomas More defined it as a problem when he wrote Utopia. The Greeks defined it as a problem. And those elites have evolved as economies have evolved. Is there more transparency? Is there more mobility? There certainly is. Does that mean that the imbalance in terms of influence isn't a problem for the world? We've just been through a financial crisis that was one of the most remarkable experiences any of us have seen, where for 20 years the financial community said, get off our back, we don't need regulation, we'll handle things on our own, leave it to the markets. Pushing away the governments, and the governments didn't set the rules, they bought the rules from these people, or they were sold the rules. And then what happened after that? As soon as they got into trouble, as a consequence of their greed and overreaching, they picked up the phone and they said, bail us out. What happened after that? As soon as they were bailed out and back on their feet, they got on the phone and said, get off our back again. They profited from this process.
And this shows that there's a small, this is an example of a small interlocking group of people who defy the rules of the state and the private at the same time, the rules of competition of the private sector and the rules of accountability of the state. And we don't have the same information that they have. I disagree that there's more transparency.
It's hard to disagree that we don't need better rules. It's hard to disagree that the financial system needs to be better regulated. But when we speak about states, let's not be abstract. We're talking about the Chinese state. We're talking about the Russian state. We're talking about states in the Middle East. Are those the states that you would like to be imposing
the
rules?
Before we talk about the states. Yeah. Don't you think that those elites have more in common among themselves than with the rest of us? I'll give you an example. The 70 people who are running or in the boards of the five most important companies in the world are also on the board of the other 150 companies that are leading in the world. They certainly have more in common than the rest of us.
Yes, and I think that's the only way you can explain the process of globalization over the last 30 years. You know, the typical elite has cultural loyalty to their own community, etc. But their economic and increasingly political loyalties are across borders.
They are certainly harmonizing the world.
That's not true.
Of the past several decades, which include end of the Cold War, for example, there are many more spaces that are unregulated by traditional governments, by international organizations, that where the players themselves are making up the rules of the game. Now, that's not necessarily bad. However, they are necessarily unaccountable through the traditional mechanisms that we have.
Underline that. Regardless of which states,
because they play multiple roles. They span different roles. They span states. They span business. They work in think tanks. They work in media. And they can't be constrained to any of those. Hence their influence. And hence also the fact that they're not accountable.
David, listen, guys.
Globalization has helped hundreds of millions of people. The bottom has risen in the world. Has the top risen more quickly? Yes. Has inequality grown in the world? Yes. Are there some states that are useful? Yes. Are there some states that are corrupt?
And is there more competition at the top? Yes. More slippery at the top? Yes.
But there's more harmonization in today's world.
These aren't mutually exclusive ideas. There can be more competition. It can be more transparent. And there can be imbalances that ought to be addressed. And the reason that we...
You are describing something that has always been with us since
Global.
It is totally different.
And so the challenge here
totally
is to identify what is it that is different from what it was always there.
Let me finish, I'll do it. And that is that throughout history, we've developed mechanisms to try to balance the imbalances. Those were national governments that had tools within borders to do it. Now, much of this debate has moved off into a kind of a global space where national governments have less teeth and where the rest of the people, those hundreds of millions of Chinese who've been benefited by globalization, have less of a mechanism by which they can ensure that the people at the top don't go outside the bounds of what's in the collective interest. Because what's in the collective interest ought to have a seat at the table, and at a lot of these discussions, the vast majority of people aren't at the table.
But it did have a seat at the table, and now that has changed. When the Citibank and Goldman Sachs, etc., walk into the Treasury and walk into the Congress, there still is this assumption, and we have a problem with language, that they are our corporations. They get more than 50% of their business from outside the country. Why wouldn't they be thinking globally and not about the future of the United States?
Well, let's talk about that a bit in the sense of not only the financial and the economic, but also in the sense of the security and the security and the military. The questions of life and death. Can we think of a war in the Middle East without, for example, certain oil elites having a say? Or without certain military elites? Is the military-industrial complex that President Eisenhower warned us against, is it now present under probably the most liberal of all American presidents in the last century?
Unfortunately, tragically, wars are always decided by a small group of people that send other people's children to die. that has been true before, and it is true now.
But it's supposed to be accountable governments, not corporations with influence over governments, to advance their economic, military, or other interests.
If there were no oil in the Middle East, the United States wouldn't care about the Middle East. It wouldn't care about Israel. It wouldn't care about Palestine. It wouldn't care about social development in Iraq. It wouldn't care about the Taliban. If there were no oil, and the interests who benefit from that oil and who advocate for that oil and who have done so and who have shaped American foreign policy over the course of the past 70 years as a consequence of that oil are big businesses.
Yeah. But as Jeanine would say, how can you tell the difference since they are in and out of government, into the big corporations, back in government? Right. How do we know when is it government and when is it the private sector?
Well, and I think one of the key issues now for the United States for in the military arena is who's making the decisions about national security. So the question is not that it's just elites. Of course, elites have always made the decisions, but the question is, who are these elites? How are they organized? That's the question we need to understand, because the world does change.
Well, by its very nature, the global market, and the name of the show is Empire, and an empire requires these kinds of relationships. Mm-hmm. It's not that these people got up one morning and said, we want to be part of this global elite. This is an evolution that occurs, and they're connected to their institutions.
And if I can add...
You have the last word before we go to break, Moises.
Empire assumes that there is a center that is a hegemonic center that calls the shots and defines what are the economic interests, and that defines the security and military decisions. All I want to say is that that empire, which by implication here is the United States, has a lot of competitors these days. And there is a lot that this empire, the United States, would like to do that cannot do anymore.
We're going to carry on the discussion after we're going to come back from a news break. And before we do, we're going to have Diana Ferrero report on the expanding role of the softer power elites.
It seems as if at times celebrity can bring that focus.
I find refugees just the most extraordinary people.
Over the past 10 years, the richest rock stars, business and media moguls started using their billions and their brands for good causes around the world. In the fight against poverty, AIDS, malaria, and refugees.
Can't make the policies, but you can bring a camera where you go because they'll follow you and you can shine a light on it.
This is how these celebrities became global philanthrocapitalists, self-entitled superheroes.
AIDS drugs to Africans who can't afford them.
Off on a mission to save the world.
That seems to be my job.
When people get involved in Africa, it's an ego trip. If you look for the mythology, it's Tarzan. I'm Tarzan. I'm here to save you. The power of all the mass of people saying, thank you, thank you. It's almost an evangelical, almost like a prophet.
Celebrities can be very influential through this kind of soft power.
We ask only what the politicians promised.
Politicians are seen as agents of their own countries. Celebrities are seen as agents of something larger than a country. They are seen as somehow part of a fantasy world.
It was really a privilege to sit down today earlier with President Obama.
Angelina Jolie said, I can phone up presidents of countries I've never been to, and they'll take my phone call. So I think that's where celebrity has tremendous power.
Their global appeal is unquestionable, but do they have the political credentials to be world ambassadors and to mobilize governments?
Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Are you all going to school?
So Bono, the front man of U2, particularly because of his Christian beliefs and so forth, he was able to mobilize the right wing of American public opinion. And I think that's one of the reasons why the Bush administration was so effective on Africa.
C'est une jolie fille.
On the other hand, you know, I worry a bit about people like Madonna flying into African countries and then sort of adopting children without much research into whether that child was even an orphan or not. Philanthrocapitalism is controversial because having rich people use their private money to do things that we've traditionally thought of as a government's responsibility, it feels like maybe it's a step back towards the Middle Ages or something. You know, I think another risk is philanthrocapitalists are very much pursuing their own personal agenda.
Take Oprah. the richest American TV queen who has an entire media empire to spread her own influence.
I do believe he's the one, Barack Obama!
When she supported Barack Obama's campaign for presidency, I think that helped a lot.
When you educate a girl, you begin to change.
Oprah funded entirely a school for orphaned girls in South Africa. Again, you could say cynically that she was making her own publicity over this, but you could also say that she was doing some good as a result.
We wanted to do our part to give every person the chance to live a healthy and productive life.
But giving money away is not easy. Beyond a welcome tax break, billions and billions may end up in the wrong hands, boosting the wrong government.
A lot of the traditional government aid policies tended to create dependency. They used to foster a culture of corruption. You tended to write a large check to an African government, and then most of it would go off to Switzerland in a private bank account.
Bono, George Clooney, Angelina Jolie, name any, Bill Clinton, who are they hugging? Not the local people. They're arm in arm with the dictator, invariably, or with the head of state.
People around the world who see one of these super class billionaires need to ask a few questions about them. Why are they advocating this and not something else? Why are they behind this? What is their self-interest and what is their motivation? And why is the problem not being solved without their attention?
The challenge that I think philanthrocapitalism is helping to answer is how do we help in a way that's constructive rather than destructive?
Welcome back. Nowhere is the power of global elites as pronounced and amplified as when they influence government security and economic policies through the revolving door between the private and the public sectors. And nowhere is it as obvious as when former politicians use their resumes to effect change. Carter, Blair, Clinton, Brzezinski, Schroeder, Thatcher, Gorbachev, Annan, Mandela are now global brand names. Before we continue the discussion on the good, the bad, and the ugly global elites, with my guests, David Rothkopf, Jeanine Waddell, Moises Naim, and Jeff Foe, Juan Pablo Raymond takes a look at one certified member whom you, David, called brilliant and charming. Here's Henry Kissinger, the man and his associates.
The U.S. was attacked. The government needed a reliable figurehead. Who did they call?
The new Secretary of State.
Dr. Henry Kissinger, perhaps the most controversial Secretary of State ever.
Today I sign an act of Congress.
They chose him to chair the 9/11 Commission. 30 years on, the U.S. had still turned to Kissinger for his opinion and counsel.
Henry Kissinger is still thought of as an authoritative figure, almost above politics.
He can open doors, he can get in to see important people.
Arriving in America as a German immigrant, he quickly rose to the top. But who is Henry Kissinger? A gifted statesman? A Machiavellian manipulator? A peacemaker? A war criminal? Or all of the above?
Henry Kissinger was accused, correctly say, of murdering people in Chile or Argentina or East Timor.
Despite this dark history, Dr. Kissinger became a global celebrity, very much in the public eye. His company, however, Kissinger and Associates, successfully operates under the radar. And it seems that for Kissinger, his company's clients come first.
Having said what an honor it was to be appointed to chair the 9/11 Commission, it took only days before Mr. Kissinger said, but not if it means I have to declare my international clientele.
So what is so special about his client list? What is there to hide?
We know Kissinger Associates had Milosevic, Yugoslavia, as its client when he was butchering the Muslims of the Balkans. We know that they had Chinese clients when the students in Tiananmen Square were being butchered.
Kissinger and Associates have been extremely adept at spinning the revolving door. And in spite of its low profile, bordering on total secrecy, the known list of former employees reads like a who's who of power. Brent Scowcroft, Bill Richardson, Paul Bremer, and Tim Geithner, President Obama's Treasury Secretary. The list goes on.
Certainly the revolving door has corrupted the process. They serve in office, they come out, and they get snatched up by private firms, and they use the information they've acquired to further the business interest of their employer and the clients of the employer. That's what the revolving door is all about.
And power breeds access to more power. Dr. Kissinger became the most frequent visitor to the White House during the run-up to the Iraq War.
Dealing with weapons of mass destruction in Iraq cannot wait.
President Obama sent him to Russia to negotiate a nuclear disarmament initiative.
It poses a pretty clear conflict of interest, since it's been reported that he has business in Russia and other parts of the former Soviet Union, so how he could possibly be an honest broker.
Whether he was convincing George W. to attend the Beijing Olympics, giving Sarah Palin a crash course in international affairs, having regular calls with Putin, or dispensing advice to Hillary Clinton.
Well, I like Henry, too.
Kissinger is still at the center of U.S. diplomacy. With influence where it matters, his company unlocks doors.
They've never met a dictator that they don't like, or a shady corporation that they don't like, and they love introducing the one to the other, which is why there's no transparency. You're not allowed to know exactly who the client list is. And
so, despite this blurred line and the various allegations of involvement in coups and war crimes, this 87-year-old Cold War warrior who once said power is the ultimate aphrodisiac still lingers at the heart of global affairs.
David, you've written something fascinating in your book. You said that since Henry Kissinger was National Security Advisor, every other security advisor at the White House had either worked for Kissinger or worked for someone who worked for Kissinger. That's quite an amazing demonstration of what does it mean to be an revolving door and having such influence over government.
Well, I don't think it's a demonstration of what it means to have a revolving door at all. I think it's a demonstration of the fact that the U.S. foreign policy community is very small, and that Henry Kissinger was a larger-than-life figure for a whole variety of reasons that had to do with the way he used power, the people he identified, and the role that he's been able to continue to play because of his intellectual views. You can accuse Henry Kissinger of a lot of things in terms of his policies. You can debate many of them. You can even condemn some of them, and I think some of them deserve to be condemned.
But that's what's interesting about power, is that power, that's what, as we move to the second half of our show, is not just about wealth, as we talked in the first half of the show, that sometimes power is also about a phone book, is about being an inspiration, about having a political political clout.
It's about who your friends are and so forth. But I got to tell you, if you wanted to sort of have a tug of war of power, and you had Kissinger Associates on one side, and you had Lloyd Blankfein's granddaughter he's the CEO of Goldman Sachs on the other, I'd take Lloyd Blankfein's granddaughter, okay? Because certain organizations have much bigger clout, much greater resources. Personal relationships play a much bigger role. Now, is Henry Kissinger the most influential figure in U.S. foreign policy in the past 50 years? Almost certainly. It has nothing to do with the commercial element.
Well, no, of course not. As we move to the second half, we're talking about Mandela is not a part of the commercial element. Certainly not Carter, right?
No, but it's just the implications
and
of
not
this.
Clinton. No, not at all. What we're saying is, in our second half of the show, is that power as an accumulation of means, wealth is only one of those means. And as we know, as you state very clearly, and I thought very well in your book, that it is amazing that every national security advisor for the last 40 years has been associated with Henry Kissinger. Don't you think that's fascinating?
There is no doubt that Kissinger is very influential, that has played an important role, that a lot of people associated with him continue to wield power. But as David said, there are a lot more people that are quite influential. The head of some sovereign wealth funds in the Middle East, or the heads of some very important companies in Asia, are far more important than Kissinger, and far more associated with some shady causes.
If that's such influence, what you're saying is there are so many other people in the world, even with more influence,
well,
as you're saying,
about,
then there's certainly
networks.
A global elite out there.
This is about networks. It's not about individuals. And David knows much more about Henry Kissinger than I do. But I would say that while it's probably true that this was his life was not motivated by commerce, commerce is never absent from any of these elites. The interrelationships and the financial relationships, and who gets, not only who gets the money in his or her pocket, but who gets to decide who gets the money. The money is very important in all of these issues, national security as well as economic. And I think we would need to understand that this is about networks. If it wasn't Henry Kissinger who helped Nixon do what they did in Chile, for example, in the early 1970s, it probably would have been somebody else. So I think there's a system here, and some people are better at the system than others, and Kissinger is one of them.
But that's exactly what the point is. It's the generic aspect of it all. It's not the person. It's not that one particular example. You, Professor Waddell Jenin, you spoke a lot about this idea of the revolving door, or as you mentioned to me before the show, the evolving door.
Right. It's now called the evolving door because so many more people, for example, in this country who are working in governing are outside of formal governing. You have a tremendous growth of contractor workforce, then growth in number of advisory boards and their importance according to the Congressional Research Service. You have, you know, growth of think tanks and changing of think tanks and their involvement in governing and policy. So you have a proliferation of entities, and so the top power brokers tend to wear these different hats, and are, you know, lots of different places simultaneously and in short duration of time. And again, their titles inaccurately convey the power and influence that they actually wield. This is one of the features of our age, and the key challenge is the issue of accountability. And I think that is really, things are not nearly as transparent as we like to think they are. When we talk about top power brokers, who is really able to connect the dots? It's usually the people who are involved in those situations themselves.
There are plenty of revolving doors. And I think in some places you can see clear consequences of corruption. The people who have influence in terms of financial policy almost inevitably go to work for financial institutions. They came from financial institutions. Their long-term financial interests are associated with those, and they're also caught up in the culture of those places, what the ideas that are current, and that has a corrupting effect, and it's something that needs to be counterbalanced. Is it true in every aspect of government? No. Most politicians go off after politics and disappear, have very, very, very limited influence. But in a few of these key areas, the revolving door, the connections, do play an influential role. And it's something that systems need to look at and try to filter out.
But it is a clear conflict of interest there, isn't it?
Yes, sure.
Well, whereas it's now called a coincidence of interest, because players are moving around and they're structuring their roles.
Or Jeanine, is it a question of, it's good to have multiple roles in the sense that you have experience in the private sector, you have the previous experience in the government. Right. A lot of people in the private sector think that they know better than the people in government.
And that's probably a mistake. Having great success in the private sector is very often far easier than having success in the public sector. Managing many restrictions in the public sector is far more difficult in the face of great pressures than in the public sector. But I wanted to also highlight another part of your presentation, which I thought was very interesting, and that is the use of celebrities in advancing philanthropic or other political social causes. The reason why that has become part of our trends these days, in which you get George Clooney and Angelina Jolie and others to become activists, is because in large measure the world doesn't care about these issues. So people that care about these issues borrow the allure of these celebrities. So what they're doing is borrowing the constituency that Angelina Jolie has to say, pay attention to Haiti. And if I don't send Angelina Jolie to Africa or to some places, largely the world doesn't care.
Two drawbacks. Perhaps you can take it in your consideration.
I would say that the profile of these elites, at least the ones that I'm tracking, shadow elite, has changed in the past 20 30 years. And one of the aspects is that you have to be able to brand your message. And then, of course, with the decline of investigative reporting.
No, we have more information. There's less investigative journalism on the part of the large media, but there are hundreds of people exposing them.
And I think the issue is we are more
transparent now than before, Janine. These elites are more scrutinized than they were before. We're not living in the dark ages that you portray. We're living in far more transparent
ages. Both things are true. They're more scrutinized, right. But there's also more hidden because they're hidden in this forest of
Than before, they're more hidden than before.
Yes.
So we now know less than what we knew in the mid 1950s. It depends on who we is.
If you're talking about people who spend their time looking at the internet and finding out these little niches of investigative reporting, sure, there's more information. But if you're asking about the average person who works for a living and comes home and turns on the television and sees this 15-second spot, no.
But Moises's point is unassailable, whether it's in the Middle East, the developing world, as a consequence of satellite television or the internet or phones, as a consequence of the proliferation of blogs, the accessibility to local media, the ability to translate that media. The world is swimming in information today as it never had before. And what he was saying simply about Angelina Jolie and others is they are part of the political process. They move the spotlight to an issue, and that's how you mobilize action. And for that, there is nothing that can be condemned. Would it be better if the world... no one. But I mean, I don't know that you were, but I think he was making a point, and I'm merely trying to support it, which is the world would be better off if it didn't take Bono and Angelina Jolie to care about the tragedy of Africa. But it does, and they help.
Before I go back to solutions, I just want to go back to one point that you've raised. It's very important to me because we're sitting in a media organization. It seems to me, Moises, that there has been a lot of manufacturing of consent, as one radical intellectual put it, in the sense that those very same global elites own the media in so many parts of the world. And information is not an easy thing to come by. Bloggers can express their opinions. But the major news outlets in the world are owned or run by the global elites. How do you expect then all this transparency you talk about to come out there to the public sphere?
I do believe that media is going through a complex transition. That transition is driven by new technologies like the internet and other modalities. But I also believe, and I do believe
that... But they're all monopolies.
There are more monopolies that have a very hard time just fending off and containing the competition that is happening around the world. I don't know, what would you rather have as a tool of influence, Google or CBS? Would you rather have CBS? We are Al Jazeera. Who is more influential?
These are my choices?
Well, there are more
Jazeera,
than... Wait a second. There are more than what you had just 10 years ago. Today, you have Google, you have Facebook, you have even Twitter. That is changing the way people are consuming and producing and distributing information and is shaping the debate with far more competition than ever before in the history of humanity.
I think it's changing it's not getting at the question of power.
Which I want to get to you because I think you're the one among all my four guests, who have almost dedicated half of your book to the question of solutions. So I'm going to ask you to wrap up on the questions that you ended with your books. David, you spoke about balancing freedom and justice. You're going to have to explain this to us. Janine, you concluded with two words, public responsiveness. That's it. You had no other words because you wanted to pose the problem then give solutions. You spoke about everything from the European model to workers of the world unite. I think you wanted the return of the states in order at least to resolve the question of the shadow elites. Can we wrap it up, please? David, you start.
Well, I think what I meant by freedom and justice is competition, and some of the things Moises has been talking about has been hugely beneficial for the world, and you do want to give as much freedom as possible in the markets. But you also need a voice for the people who aren't at the table. You need a voice for the disenfranchised. You need counterbalances, and those come in the form of governments. Right now, they come in the form of national governments, and there is a void on the international stage to address these issues that are out there in terms of the global sphere. We need stronger international institutions, stronger international laws, more to assure that the little guy has leverage in the system against the big guy. And that's going to produce, I think, a revolution in the way the world is governed in the next 70, 100 years that's roughly akin to what happened in the middle of the 17th century as we went from a feudal system to a system of nation states.
We're in an accountability crisis because the profile of today's what I call shadow elites has changed. But when government itself is complaining and is demonstrating in report after report that it itself doesn't have the tools, it doesn't have the basic information that it's paying for in many crucial areas to do what it needs to do, then that's a real problem of accountability. And we need to, first of all, develop the mechanisms to understand this issue.
Transparency.
I think the central problem is that what contained and connected the elites with ordinary citizens has been broken. Mm-hmm. And that's the national boundaries. And what you've got is that you've created a politics, a political networks, Kissinger, etc., that crosses borders. But the politics for ordinary people doesn't cross borders. And it seems to me that we've got to figure out how to broaden the connections between the people who aren't at these tables and the people who aren't making these presentations and the people who aren't in that network. So we've got to democratize the process.
The world has changed in ways that makes it very, very hard for a small group of people to do whatever they want. That exists, and there is no denial that there is a limited amount of people that have great influence, but these people are being challenged, constrained, displaced, and very often sent home or killed and lose their power. First point. Second point, increasingly, the number of problems that cannot be solved by any country or any elite acting alone is mounting. Increasingly, the world needs collaboration, cooperation, coordination, and that is the main challenge because these three things are related to power.
Gentlemen, Professor Waddell, thank you so much for joining Empire. Our time is up. I'll be back with a final note. When it comes to global elites, numbers speak louder than words. Some statistics might give you a clear idea about the size, influence, and scope of these global giants. The top 1% of the world's richest own 40% of the planet's global wealth, and the top 10% control 85% of its wealth. The top 10 corporations generate 60% of their revenues and employ 59% of their workforce overseas. The 70 CEOs and board members of the largest five companies are also on the boards of the top 150 companies. And the average international corporation had 100 subsidiaries in the 1960s. Today, it has 10,000 subsidiaries. In the final analysis, whether these giants cooperate or compete, their actions and interactions are shaping the future of our planet like never before. So my question to you is, if they account for so much of the world's wealth and power, who are they accountable to? And that's the way it goes.